Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. So good evening and welcome to Feed Your Head. I'm Ruthanna Martin-Theo, and my first guest tonight is Guy McPherson. Hello, Guy.
Hi, Ruthanna. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you here because you've got so much that we can learn. You have given up a tenured position as a professor at a major university to move basically off-grid, and you wrote your 10th, that's 10 book called Walking Away from Empire, explaining that. Do you want to tell us why you left? A lot of people would say, wow, you know, he's tenured at a university. He's got it made.
Why? Yeah, he must be.
Yeah.
Must be crazy. That's the only explanation I can think of.
Exactly. I'm sure that people said that. So what do you say to that?
I won't necessarily refute that, but I do have my own side of the story. I'm not sure if it's a mark of sanity or insanity anymore. I was part of the culture. Universities are part of the culture, and the culture is driven by growth at all costs. And we are constantly hit with the message that says we can have infinite growth on a finite planet. And I didn't believe that message. I haven't believed that message for a long time. Operating within the university and pointing out the limits to growth within a system that is disbelieving, or at least finds anathema promoting that message, is something that's difficult to do for an extended period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I viewed the culture as insane. And so maybe that's an indication of my sanity more than the culture's. But it just became increasingly difficult and finally too difficult to remain embedded within that system.
Right. Well, what did your family, your immediate family, and then say brothers and, you know, aunts and uncles, parents, what did they say when you said, okay, this is it, I'm getting out of here?
Well, it's pretty interesting. My family is characterized by lifelong educators. My parents were lifelong educators. My dad was the superintendent, the principal. Well, initially the fifth grade teacher, and then the principal, and then the superintendent of the high school I graduated from. And my brother is a professor at a small liberal arts college in Eastern Washington State. My sister works within the educational system. That's my whole family right there. But I had the brass ring. You know, I'd reached the pinnacle of the educational world by being a full professor by the age of 40. And so they thought it was a little unusual, to say the least, that I should leave a position like that. And it is, admittedly, quite unusual. And the rumor going around, I actually heard this from somebody outside of the state where I worked for so long. The rumor was that I was actually insane. I had a colleague come up to me and say, so what do you have? And I looked at her, I don't know what you're talking about. She said, you know, the whole brain disease thing.
Okay.
You know, academics are always looking for the explanation, the cause behind the behavior. So clearly I was insane. So they were looking for the mechanism behind it.
Wow. She was serious, or was she just tongue in cheek?
Oh, no, she was dead serious.
Wow. Okay, that's it's funny, but it's almost scary that somebody actually who knew you would think that, yeah. Well, how long ago did you do this? Did you go insane? You consider it insanity. I think it sounds like heaven, but how long ago did you do this, Guy?
Well, I made the trip to the dark side a really, really long time ago. I moved here full-time to this place off the grid right about 4 years ago. my wife and I committed to this place. It's a shared property. We share it with another couple and their 10-year-old son. And we made the commitment to this place in, I believe it was August or September 2007. So it's 5.5, 6 years ago now. And we'd been looking for a while for a place to move to and go off the grid. I'd been looking for 2 or 3 years before that, I guess. I guess it dated to early 2005 when we first started looking. So I crossed the Rubicon of insanity quite a while ago.
Okay. Well, you were teaching in that area? Or, I mean, how did you come to find this great property? Because this seems, I know a lot of people want to go off the grid, but then they're having issues on property here and there and codes and different things like that.
Yeah, it was not easy. I started looking for this place in early 2005 and finally landed here in late 2007. So it was 2.75 years, essentially, before finding this place. And we had several criteria in mind. We wanted a place that didn't get either life-threateningly hot or life-threateningly cold. So in the Southwest, it had to be at a reasonably high elevation. We're at 4,600 feet elevation here. And it had to be at a place with shallow water. The static water level here is 20 feet or about 6 meters down. So it's easily accessible with hand pumps and solar pumps. Mm-hmm. It had to be a place that had relatively deep soil so we could grow food. And this place meets that criterion. And it had to be in a rural area with not all that many people around, and within a tank of gas drive of Tucson, Arizona, where I was working for all those years.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's just intractable to make any of it work if you're more than a tank of gas drive away. So we ended up about 250 miles from Tucson in New Mexico when we found these people who were willing to partner with us. And that actually made for an ideal arrangement, especially in the beginning when we weren't living here, because we were having a straw bale house built, and we were getting animals, you know, ducks and chickens and geese and goats. And see, somebody has to be here all the time to make that work.
Yeah.
So it was pretty convenient to still be able to work at the university while we were getting the house built and getting the infrastructure developed, but still having the ability to come over here on weekends to participate in those activities.
Yeah, that does sound ideal, but you're right. A tank of gas, it shouldn't be more than that. If you're still doing a job and going to be commuting, that's plenty far. So do you miss the university, Guy?
Every single day, I miss working with inmates and honor students. That's who I was working with in the classroom.
Okay.
In my latter years, I wasn't teaching in my home department anymore because the department head's prerogative is to assign teachers to classes, and I wasn't assigned to any when my last department head was brought in. So I was teaching through the Honors College and teaching poetry in various incarceration facilities. And I miss that every single day. Those are wonderful people. And I did that for a long time. Yes, I very much miss it.
Do you keep in touch with the people that you used to know there and work with?
With a few. There's a few colleagues who probably because of insanity themselves, think that I'm still worth communicating with. But they are remarkably few. So, for example, the colleague who founded Poetry Inside Out, which is the institution, the organization that facilitates teaching poetry inside of incarceration facilities as well as out, including my honors courses, I get together with her every month or so. When I make a trip into Tucson. And one or two of my former colleagues still will tolerate a visit with me and will have me guest lecture in their classes.
I was going to ask if you're guest lecturing. at the old place. Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit less. You know, it's been 4 years now since I was there full time. And so those ties start to break and wither after a while, as you would expect.
Yeah.
But I still do guest lecture once or twice a year on campus. And then I take these speaking tours, and I frequently interact with college students when I'm on them. Because if I'm in a college town and I'm willing to teach in any number of classes, as I am, then people take advantage of that. And so, you know, I've taught in on recent speaking tours, I've guested in courses that range from English composition to environmental science to creative writing to international peace studies. So a wide array of courses that I'm pretty comfortable in.
Yeah, you're pretty much a Renaissance man. All of these different interests you have, and you're teaching those, and then, heavens, you built a straw bale house and you live off the grid. So you've pretty much covered it, I would think. Now,
well, I built a straw bale house only in the sense that I was writing an extraordinary number of large checks.
Your hands not get into the bale then.
No, you know, at that point, this was 2008, the house was being built, and I could barely distinguish between a screwdriver and a zucchini. Well, I certainly didn't want to live in a house that I had built at that point in my life. So okay. We had a professional builder build the house.
Now, do you know the difference between a screwdriver and a zucchini?
Oh, yes. I built a partially subterranean straw bale greenhouse of my own. We're growing citrus. We're growing citrus in this greenhouse at a place where it gets well below zero every year for a month. So I've built some pretty incredible structures, and I have the broken fingers to show it, too, from where the hammer hit.
Well, that is the way to learn.
Yes. Yes, it is.
They say that, now what is it? You're supposed to use pliers or something to hold the nail like with one hand, and then you use the hammer with the other so that you don't squash your thumb or something. I don't know. I just hold it and sometimes hit my thumb. So good. So now you can build your own straw bale, anything. A subterranean greenhouse. That's wonderful.
Well, I'm a little reluctant still to live in something that I build, but I'm happy to put the trees in there.
But the trees haven't suffered yet. So, okay.
They're stunningly, they're still alive. So
what kind are they? What kind of citrus are you growing?
There's a couple each of grapefruit, lemon, lime, and orange. So a pretty wide slate. And I've built several cold frames. They're sometimes called hot boxes. Mm. They're little mini greenhouses pretty close to the ground.
Yeah.
Lots of other extensive beds as well. And a straw bale chicken coop, house for the ducks, a well-insulated shed for the goats.
Oh.
So I'm pretty comfortable now, you know, beating my thumb with a hammer. I got no problem with that at all.
No, I think that's wonderful. You've come a long way then.
Oh, very much so. And so now I can do minor plumbing work and a little bit of masonry tile work. And, you know, I ran drip irrigation system over the entire 2.6 acres to have water to the orchard and to the gardens and all that sort of thing. So
okay, that would be such a necessity. How many acres do you have now?
It's about 2.6 acres,
okay.
And this couple and their son had been living here for a few years before we moved here. So 2.6 acres with five human beings, two goats, a dozen ducks, and a couple dozen chickens.
Okay. And you do have a rooster, you told me.
Oh, yes. Yes. One rooster and I think 18 or 19 hens. I sort of lost track. We lost one or maybe two within the last couple of days. So.
Oh.
Yeah, I know.
Did they just die or do you have coyotes or what's happening?
Well, it's interesting. This one, as nearly as we can tell, just flopped over dead.
Oh.
And we do have many coyotes and mountain lions and bobcats, lots and lots of potential predators. But as nearly as we can tell, we've had probably 60 fowl here altogether. As nearly as we can tell, we've lost one that's unaccounted for, that maybe was a coyote or a
well, something else coming in.
Yeah, coyote or a bobcat or mountain lion or whatever. So we're actually doing pretty well on that front, surprisingly well.
Hey, that is well. How far are you from the nearest small town? Now, you say like you go to Tucson maybe every month or so. Is that when you get quote unquote supplies, or do you run into a local store every week or so?
No, there's a town of about 10,000 people, 35 miles away. So it has everything. It has a couple of hardware stores and a few grocery stores and drug stores and that sort of thing. So it's a real legitimate town.
Right. 10,000 people with those. Yeah, that's a real town. It's not 300. I have some friends in Eastern Tennessee. They didn't build things like you did, but they gave up California and moved to Eastern Tennessee. And they live outside of a town that's about 1,400. And it's totally different from California. Let's put it that way. they have a store there. Get this. It's called Herbs and Ammo. I love it. It's like I want to go there. And people have told me, it's hard to get to the where they live, but it's so beautiful because they have the mountain view and everything. What kind of a view do you have?
I'm looking at a set of mountains right now that have about 500,000 acres without a road in them.
Oh, you're just making me envious.
And so out my window, I have a view of the riparian corridor. The river, the free-flowing river, is about 400 yards out my window. And behind that is this mountain range. It's a beautiful, beautiful place.
Is that river a noisy one? I mean, so that you go to sleep, you can hear it. 400 yards,
No, it's pretty small stream by the time it gets down here. It is perennial for most of its reach here in New Mexico. But it dries up right adjacent to us, typically 2 months out of the year. May and June it's dry. So it's pretty much a trickle year round. In large part because it has irrigation ditches that dewater the entire river that serve the valley, so that we can grow livestock here.
Okay. We've got a couple questions in chat, and Carell said that, you were mentioning the goats and the chickens and all. He said, ducks. It's been said that managing animals means managing waste. So what do you do with your animal waste? Are you using it in the gardens or methane production? What would you suggest?
We try pretty hard to adhere to the principles of permaculture here, and so we try to have no waste. We don't view things as waste. So manure is an incredibly nutrient-rich resource for us. So goat manure is particularly useful because it's a slow-release fertilizer that you can put right on top of the gardens. So whenever we plant anything, we put a mulch layer of chopped straw and goat manure right on top of it. And then in the off-season, during the winter, we till in a bunch of chicken manure, and so far we've been fortunate enough to bring in horse and steer manure from off-site and till that in to the gardens.
All right. I know some people who have an EcoArc, and they do the humanure and everything.
So do we. We have composting toilets here in the straw bale house, so we don't have any black water that leaves the property, that leaves the house even. So we do humanure in a relatively conventional for these days composting toilet, one on each side of the house. We share this house, and it's really a duplex divided by a breezeway. So we have about a 500 square foot breezeway between the two sets of living quarters.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
And because it's so well insulated, it blocks most of the sound. I mentioned that the sounds I hear in the morning are the birds waking me up.
Yeah, no, that's great. And Janelle is asking about the water supply, the well or the river, but you said that it's easy to have hand pumps because the water line isn't that far down.
Right. The static water level here is about 20 feet. In fact, the original well on the property was hand dug down to 20 feet,
wow,
which is pretty impressive.
That is.
And so it was a hand dug well. I wouldn't like that job myself because you scratch the surface of the soil around here and you'd bump into a cobble, a big rock, typically the size of my fist or the size of my head. So you do that for 20 feet down, you've moved a lot of rock. But the advantage to having relatively shallow water is, in addition to the original well that was pretty shallow, at some point apparently it became dry enough here that the water level dropped below that 20 feet. So somebody came in probably during the drought of the 1950s and added 32 feet of well pipe at the bottom of that 20-foot hand-dug well. So that was a 52-foot well that had a conventional grid-tied electrical pump down 45 feet. We have replaced that with a solar pump that's down 45 feet. And we drilled another well when we first started. It goes down 103 feet into the conglomerate layer. And it has a solar pump down 90 feet and a hand pump running along beside it. It goes down 45 feet. So those are three sources of water, two solar pumps and a hand pump. We also harvest rainwater off two roofs, the new straw bale house and the old fallen down mobile home that our partners occupied before we had the new house built. And so that's five sources of water that we use from on site. And push comes to shove, we would do what people did here for 10,000 years before, about 150 years ago. We walked down to the river and get our water.
There you go. Well, now then that means that somebody had lived on this property right there before.
Yes. In fact, there were probably people here on this property for 100 years, more or less. And our partners lived here for about 5 years before I moved here full time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So they'd been here about 3 years, I guess, when we signed the agreement with them, the legal agreement to get all the names on the deed and sharing the property legally as well as in practice.
Right. Well, so then their son was quite young when they moved there. So this is basically the only home he's known.
Yes, absolutely. He was born within a few months of them moving here. I can't remember which side, though, whether he was born before they moved here or after. But yes, this is the only home he's ever known.
Wow. And then now, does he go to school? Is he homeschooled?
He's homeschooled. There's quite a significant homeschooling movement here, and both of his parents are very well educated in the conventional American sense. And so his takes primary responsibility. That's her job, basically, is she homeschools him for 4 to 5 hours a day every weekday. He goes into the local K-12 school at least one day each school year and is given the opportunity to pursue public education if he would like. And so far, he's been quite frustrated by that experience and uninterested because it takes them, you know, half an hour to get through a worksheet. He does five of these worksheets in 5 minutes one-on-one with his mother. So he is a surprisingly knowledgeable 10-year-old. He has a vocabulary that my honor students would be impressed with.
Wow. So, okay, then the question, and I know we're just veering, but we're talking about living off the grid. What about the fact that he doesn't really have that many other kids to socialize with?
Oh, but in fact, he does.
Oh, okay.
There's quite a homeschooling group here.
Oh.
And he is constantly getting together with them or with other groups to do any number of things. Just in the 4 years I've been living here, he's sort of gone through these groups where he'll spend 6 months to 3 years interacting with the soccer gang and the origami group. and the primitivists. So now he goes in once a week and with a bunch of other kids and takes a primitive living course for half a day once a week. And so he has a surprising number of opportunities to interact with people of all ages.
Yeah. Well, that was, I only asked that because I know some people who are homeschooling and they're so protective of the child that she has no friends. She is just totally, I mean, she's smart enough. That's not the issue, but she just doesn't interact with other kids. And she's a teenager now, and that's just pretty rough. So good for him. Good for them.
Well, right. And I think that's a pretty standard rap against homeschooling. It was when I was in school, and homeschoolers were viewed as a little strange. They were almost always fundamentalist in some form of religion. And because my parents were in the public school system, there was that bias against homeschoolers as well. But sure, some of that has stuck around. But I think homeschooling has been around long enough now that people who are relatively thoughtful about it can provide opportunities for their kids to have social interaction.
Right, if they want to, they can. That was something that I had figured out. If I were to have children, they would be homeschooled. And it wouldn't just be me, because you always have people around who know something more about some topic than you do, or at least I do. And it's like, okay, I would definitely be using the village. But,
right.
You know, I know some other kids that are homeschooled, and they're very well adjusted, and they're very bright. Like you're saying, it takes him 5 minutes to do something. It takes the kids in the other school a half hour. So that's probably a shock to him every year when he goes there.
Yes, no doubt. And, you know, and he knows most of those kids when he's there at school because he's interacting with them.
Yeah.
Outside of school.
Right, right. And still so far ahead. But what would you say if somebody says, wow, you know, this sounds ideal. How can I just leave all this behind? What would be the best advice or your first thing that you would advise them to do?
Well, there are so many different models to choose from at this point. You know, I'm constantly bombarded with the criticism that I could only do this, that my wife and I could only do this because we made all this money as part of the system before we broke out of the system. And so everybody says, well, I can't do that because I don't have enough money and that sort of thing. Well, exactly 1 mile up the road from me are 19 acres comprising a land trust shared by 13 individuals. And with the exception of a family of four, none of them are related to each other. And they're growing a vast majority of their food, and they have solar panels, and they all live off the grid, and not a single one of them has a significant amount of fiat currency. They're working together in community because that's an inexpensive way to live. They're doing that here. They could live the way they live there very, very, very inexpensively anywhere in this country, but they choose to live here because it's a beautiful place to live.
Right.
And I have other neighbors, including one half a mile away, who have access to lots and lots and lots of fiat currency, far more than I would have had I worked an entire career. Mm-hmm. And for some of these people, it's a second home. You know, for one of the couples, their first home is in New York City, and this is where they spend a majority of their time. They could live anywhere else they wanted in the world, but they choose to live here because it's just a beautiful place with a human community that is, it staggers on astonishing for me. The acceptance, the appreciation for alternative viewpoints is something that's pretty rarely encountered, especially in rural areas such as this.
Sure.
So when people ask me how to take that first step, I'm not really sure to answer. It took me a long time. You know, I was looking to make this move basically from late 2004 and didn't make the move until late 2007, didn't make the commitment until late 2007, didn't make the move for another year and a half after that. It's a process that takes some pretty significant planning and gazing inward to figure out if this is the way you want to live and these are the people you want to live with.
What have been the major things that you would say that maybe that you miss or that you're happy to miss? What are the advantages now to living like you do?
Well, the advantage is the traffic. I mean, that's huge. Yeah. You know, Tucson, as nearly as I can tell, along with one or two other southwestern cities in the United States, represents the very apex of empire. Tucson gets its water pumped more than 300 miles across the desert uphill. Tucson gets essentially all of its food brought in from a long ways away. It gets all of the fossil fuels for heating and cooling and running the cars. There's essentially no public transportation system. So all that comes at some cost. Well, let's think about that cost for a minute. Where does the food come from? The food comes from all over the world. The closest food comes from the Central Valley in California, where migrant workers, what some people would call illegal or undocumented immigrants, are there subject to terrible abuses, yeah, being horribly underpaid and treated badly to grow food. Okay, so what does that mean in Tucson? It means you can go to any of 100 or 200 restaurants in town, and for less than 2 hours work at minimum wage, you can get a spectacular meal. Spectacular. And so as long as you don't think about the actual human and environmental costs associated with that food, you can do just fine.
Right.
But when you start thinking about them, think about what it takes to prop up a city such as Tucson with more than a million people in an area that historically supported a few dozen back when there were two perennial rivers that ran through the area. Now the water is 600 to 800 feet down below ground because it's all been sucked dry. So what I'm ecstatic about is having made a choice that better matches what I was teaching for so long, that human actions have consequences, that conservation biology, and I consider myself a conservation biologist, the ability to retain species on the planet is tied to the way we live our lives. So I'm more comfortable on a day-to-day basis with the way I live my life than when I was living at that apex of empire, the big city at the height of civilization, industrial civilization. So that manifests itself in many ways. You know, any day I can take a hike into a wilderness area. Any day I can walk a mile from here and be in community with people who appreciate me and with whom I love to interact.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of good news on a day-to-day basis. I can look at my thumb any day and realize that it no longer has that big purple bruise like it did for the first 2 years I was here. Well, that's pretty exciting all by itself.
That's something to be grateful for sure.
Well, and there's a huge reward personally associated with growing some of your own food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's the matter of collecting eggs in the morning because you built that chicken coop and you're taking care of those animals, or the milk or the cheese that comes from the goats. And there are so many of those seemingly small events that happen through the course of the day to be thankful for.
Yeah, it's idyllic. But now you do talk in some of your talks around the country and your books talk about the energy situation that we have now and the decline of fossil fuels, things like that, and how that's affecting us worldwide economically. Do you want to just touch on that a little?
Yeah, just a little bit. The five major oil companies in the world have experienced it. One quarter decline since 2006 in the amount of oil they're able to extract and deliver at the world level. So what we're doing now is we're in the era of expensive oil. So now we frack for it and we go to deep water sites like Macondo and we rely on oil shale and tar sands and all these sources that come with considerable environmental and economic costs relative to the low-hanging fruit we used to take for granted. It used to be not that long ago that the return on investment was well into the double digits. So you'd put the equivalent of one barrel of oil into the ground, and you'd get 30 or 40 or 50 barrels of oil out of the ground. Now we're in the low double digits, sometimes into the single digits. When we're talking about oil shale or corn ethanol, we're talking about almost 1-to-1. So we get barely more energy out of the ground or out of those processes than we put into those processes. That's why the oil costs $100 a barrel. When for so long, for the first nearly 150 years of oil extraction on this globe, $10 oil was extreme. That was a lot of money.
Well, so yeah, we oil is really hopefully fast, rapidly on its way out. Now you use solar. Do you think that more and more people, from solar cars to solar rooftops, are getting into it? I think it's becoming less expensive for people to do that.
Yes, it's absolutely less expensive. It won't scale, obviously, because there's not enough oil in the world to make the solar panels to get everybody's electricity provided by solar panels. So when people talk about renewables, I generally point out that really those are derivatives.
Yeah.
So it takes a lot of oil to make a wind turbine. It takes a lot of oil to make a solar panel and so on. So, yes, we are seeing a shift, and the prices are coming down considerably. Just since we started here, the solar panels we have on the roof of this straw bale house cost about $900 a panel when we started, and 3 years later they were just over $600 a panel. So yes, the price is coming down. It's becoming more affordable. It's becoming tractable. Transportation, I tend to think that car culture is the problem. And so maintaining car culture in any form probably isn't a very good idea in terms of the living planet.
Mm-hmm.
We got along for a couple, 3 million years as human animals without anything resembling a car. I'm pretty sure we don't need that.
No.
So, and here as well, solar panels we view as a luxury, not a necessity. And so the off-grid power systems that we have ultimately will fail because the batteries will fail. And then we'll be using that hand pump to get our water out of the ground. And that's okay.
Yeah. Janelle is also asking about investment and cost for just to start up off the grid. And I mean, I know it can run across a big spectrum, but what do you think that people should plan on having or getting along the way? I mean, and they may be borrowing money to do it.
Well, yeah, it depends to a great extent on how addicted you are to electricity.
Mm.
So the folks I mentioned, the land trust, the 13 people sharing 19 acres just a mile up the road from us, living in their off-grid houses. Most of those houses have a single solar panel on them. One of the houses has a 50-watt panel. That's not enough to power a 60-watt bulb.
Wow.
So he runs the 50-watt panel into a conventional car battery and is able to store the energy that way. And then he can run his laptop and he can run a light for a couple hours every night. If you want to live frugally, you can get a PV solar system that costs $1,500. And that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
We are extravagant in comparison. We have a 3.15 kilowatt PV solar system. So that's a lot of solar panels on the roof and a lot of batteries to go along with it. And that costs in the low tens of thousands of dollars. The spectrum really is quite wide. And sometimes we wish we had more electricity here. We wish we had more panels or batteries to do more things, because we get 3 or 4 days of cloudy weather. And the battery bank gets drawn down quite a ways.
Right.
But again, I think if you're really serious about getting off the grid, I think you'd be surprised at how relatively little you can get along with.
Mm-hmm.
We've grown accustomed to on-demand, inexpensive electricity, and mostly without thinking about it. And I certainly didn't think about it for the first 40 years of my life. But what does it take to maintain that? Well, it takes men with guns. That's what it takes. It takes the world's largest military so that we have grid-tied power in this country. If we didn't have the most lethal killing force in the history of the world, we would not have electricity that we could plug into in a moment's notice. We wouldn't be able to turn the lights on and always have the lights come on.
Yeah.
And so there is a cost.
That
in human terms to being connected to the grid. And so that's why the folks at the Land Trust a mile up the road refuse to be connected to the grid. For them, it's a moral imperative to live off-grid, because grid-tied electricity equals men with guns, and they just won't go there.
Yeah.
And so if that means a 50-watt solar panel, so you can write poetry on your laptop, that's what you do.
Yeah. Wow. Also, talking about that's interesting. I'm glad that he's writing poetry. There's something about that just makes my heart smile. Janelle also wanted to know, what percentage of your food do you create there?
It has varied a lot. The first year here, we got the planting mix just a little bit off. And so we were growing 100 to 150 pounds of cucumbers every day. And
what were you doing with that?
Like I said, we didn't know what we were doing, so we planted a few too many cucumbers.
Oh.
And so when they came into harvest time, wow, we were the high tide of cucumbers rolled in. Oh. And we learned a lot from that first year. And by the way, we have pickles now, if anybody wants to stop by.
I was going to say, it was days and days and days, weeks of pickling. Okay.
Right. And so we did the obvious thing. When life gives you cucumbers, you make eggs, right? So what we did was we sliced the cucumbers lengthwise and turned them out on the ground, and the ducks ate them like crazy.
Okay.
This is after we made enough pickles to last many lifetimes. By the second year, we were in pretty good shape and working pretty hard at it. Me pretty much full time, and my partners considerably less than that, I would say, grew essentially enough calories to support us for a year. And that was working really hard. That was a tough year for all of us. So since then, we've just backed off. Oh. And we're using our fiat currency. We sort of have this figured out now, is our take, and we're trying different things every year just to prove to ourselves that we really don't have it figured out. So we're trying a bunch of new things, but not trying to grow 100% of our own food. I think we are close to being able to do that. And I think none of us here view that as a primary goal anyway. We're not interested in property level self-sufficiency. We're interested in community level self-sufficiency.
Right.
So when it comes to that, when the grid fails and the trucks stop showing up at stores and all that sort of thing, the community here will be growing a bunch of things. Like we won't be growing grain on this property because that takes far too much area compared to the total area we have. So I don't see us ever growing a bunch of wheat or oats or even corn here. Instead, I see us relying on people with access to larger areas to do that. And we'll grow tomatoes and peppers and zucchinis and cucumbers like you can't believe.
Cucumbers, you know, are a good cluster. Yeah. Okay. No, that I like that. The community sufficiency instead of just the personal.
Yeah, I don't think it serves any of us to think that we can become the self-reliant mountain man who can go hole up somewhere and get along just fine without other human beings. I look through history and I don't see a lot of people who are able to do that, much less people who want to live that way. And I certainly don't want to live that way.
Right. That because we're used to so much here in this country, and you talk to people in other countries or you read about them who aren't used to any of it. So for them, I mean, and I'm not being derogatory, but I mean, it's not that hard to think about it. Although they've seen enough now of America and the Western countries that they want everything we have. And we know that this is impossible at the rate that we're going, because if we have 5% of the population of the world and we're using up 35 to 40% of the natural resources, you know, that they can't go on like that.
That, yes, that's absolutely right. And so from the beginning here, we've been very strongly focused on human community. And when I deliver presentations and in my writing, I point out that really human beings have needed four things, not to merely survive, but to thrive throughout all of human history. We've needed clean water, healthy food, the ability to maintain body temperature at some safe level, and a decent and loving human community. That's all. And so let's focus on those at the level of community. Not everybody needs to do all of those things, obviously. Not everybody needs to secure their own water and secure their own food supply and so on. But as communities, we should be thinking about those things.
All right. Yeah, that's true. I want to say we're talking with Guy McPherson, and you can find Guy at HTTP on and on. It's just guymcpherson.com, right?
Yes, that's correct. GuyMcPherson.com, and there's no A's in McPherson.
Right. Okay. And your 10th book is Walking Away from Empire. Where can we find your books?
You can go to GuyMcPherson.com, and there's a little tab up there called My Books. And also, all my books are available through conventional outlets, including online sources and conventional publishers. So if you type in Walking Away from Empire, it's your search engine, I bet it'll take you right to multiple sources.
Oh, okay.
That's just a guess. I don't spend all day typing Walking Away from Empire into my little search box.
Right. Yeah. So okay. McPherson.com and Nature Bats Last. What are your other books about? We talked about what this one was.
They really do span quite the variety of topics. My first book, interestingly enough, is a glossary. Yes, I wrote a dictionary.
Okay, you're the first person I've met who's written a dictionary. Okay.
So I wouldn't recommend that for writing or reading, either one. It's actually a glossary of fire management terms used in the United States. I was a fire ecologist and still am a fire ecologist in some of the work I do. But my first real book is called Ecology and Management of North American Savannas. I worked on savanna ecosystems for a really long time. My 17-year-old dog is named Savannah, and she's not named after the town. She's named after the ecosystem.
Oh.
And then I have books that are about climate change, which I've worked on for a long time, and various aspects of ecology and management. And then in the early 2000s, I sort of morphed into a social critic. And so my books then were written for more general audiences, lay audiences, not just my books, but also my other writings. So I started writing a lot of op-ed pieces for local newspapers and that sort of thing. So I have a book called Killing the Natives: Has the American Dream Become a Nightmare? And then I wrote one about education called Letters to a Young Academic. So I actually wrote a novel called Academic Pursuits. Another book about fire, one about land development, in particularly in exurban regions, areas a little bit further removed from suburbia. So really quite a wide array. I've had wide interests for a long time.
Yeah. What? Now, you didn't mention poetry. Did you? You taught poetry, right?
Yes.
Wait.
And
yeah. Did you?
And
your books are poetry books or not?
No. My last book has a couple of really crappy poems in it.
Yep.
You might just want to skip over when you get to those parts. I'm not a poet. We used poetry and creative writing more generally as a means to get people to tap into their
mm-hmm.
own feelings and express them, and also have conversations about topics we felt were important, but that generally were not widely talked about.
Okay.
And it's interesting when you ask somebody to write what they feel, what they think about environmental decay or about the public education system, and they start writing it as a poem, their emotions start to flow out of that. And it's fascinating and astonishing to me to see the results of that interaction. So the second day we were teaching at the men's pods of the Pima County Jail, a man probably in his 60s broke down and cried, just wept openly. And you know the cultural pressure against men crying out here. Imagine what it's like in jail.
Yeah.
And so from then on, pretty much every week somebody cried.
Oh,
We were tapping into topics and feelings that people were not tapping into. We have these topics that are just taboo in our culture. And so those are the first things we went after, of course, to get people to think and talk about.
Right. That could be amazing. And I'm sure it was for the people, because these things have been just pushed aside or way under. And then it's okay to talk about them. And they're given suggestions, because this is sort of a managed type of thing. You suggest things or give people so long to write something like that.
Yes, that's right. So we would have a conversation, often with a guest in the class. And after a 15 to 20 minute conversation, we would say, okay, let's write for a little. Let's write. What do you think about that? What does that bring up in you? And then we'd have the incarcerated individuals read back their writing and share it with the larger group. And that would start a conversation that would last for an hour or so. Great stuff.
Yeah. Well, now you're not doing that at all? Or do you occasionally go into the prisons?
Not at all. And so that's one of the things I really, really miss.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one of the reasons those people are incarcerated is because they speak truth to power.
Yes.
They're willing to say the things that most people don't say. And that's why they get locked up. And that's one of the reasons.
Yeah.
And so you can have conversations with people, honest conversations with incarcerated people that you can't have out here.
Okay.
I really miss those interactions, and I have for a long time.
So what kind of interactions with people is sort of, not exactly, but sort of taking the place of that?
There's a couple of things. I meet regularly with my neighbors around here. Coffee hour on Tuesday mornings. We go deep on a wide variety of topics because we're all old enough and living far enough outside of the mainstream culture that we're pretty comfortable talking to each other about things that most people don't talk about. And then when I go on these speaking tours, I'm hosted by people who want to have those conversations.
Yes.
That's the whole point. Mm-hmm. And when I go on these speaking tours, I stay in the homes of my hosts. I meet at their table. So what that means is we get to know each other.
Right.
And so we can have these relatively intimate conversations.
Yeah, that's something that I know I miss those conversations where people stay up all night No, and then drag off to school or work or something kind of thing. And it seems like,
right.
For me, it's I get those when I camp. And then certain people when I stay at their homes, but where I live, I don't have much of that at all. And I miss it. So good for you.
Right.
Tuesday mornings. Okay.
Right. Well, and you know, it's one of the primary reasons I go on these speaking tours. People think that I'm being very selfless and because I speak for free and just show up and give a couple of presentations a day and that sort of thing. But I'm getting a huge amount of return. I'm getting to have these conversations, these intimate conversations about important matters for extended periods of time, staying up all night.
Yes.
So it's huge fun. I'm deriving as much from it as the audiences are, I can assure you.
I always love win-win win situations. So I know I've heard you talk before that, like, you really don't think there's much hope maybe for the human race. What do you is that right? Do you think that, or do you think that we can turn some of this around, like after we go off grid? What do you think? Just instead of down the road, just give me 5 years from now. What do you think we'll be doing?
Well, I strongly suspect 5 years from now the industrial economy will have failed and the living planet will be making a comeback.
Okay.
But on the other hand, and as a conservation biologist, I've known for a really long time two things, that birth is lethal and that all species go extinct.
Mm-hmm.
We've known since 2008 when Oliver Tickle did a major synthesis in the newspaper, The Guardian, that a planet 4 degrees hotter than baseline, 4 degrees centigrade hotter than baseline, all we can prepare for is human extinction. Now, according to an informed and informative assessment of BP's Energy Outlook 2030, which came out in January of this year, global average temperature of Earth will hit the 4 degrees centigrade mark in 2030. So that indicates to me we're headed for relatively near-term human extinction. And that, you know, it doesn't make anybody a big fan of mine, including me, to be able to say that. Much less believe it, but I suspect the dozen or so self-reinforcing feedback loops we've triggered ensure that we don't have long as a species on this planet. But other species do. And so for the most part, my work now is focused on those other species and trying to retain a living planet for non-human species in our wake.
Okay. Wow. Okay. That's deep and not necessarily what we all want to hear, but
true. No, it's not a lot of fun. You know, you can imagine hearing me on a speaking tour.
Yeah.
It's just all rainbows and butterflies when I'm on stage.
Always, of course. But on the other hand, you know, there's, I don't know, if enough people are doing what you're doing, who knows? Humans may stay on the planet longer than we think.
Well, yes, and resistance is a moral imperative,
yes,
in my mind.
Yes.
Just going along with the herd is a really, really bad idea. Supporting this omnicidal set of living arrangements called industrial civilization is a horrible idea. So even if, I would say, especially if it's hopeless, that's all the more reason to resist the dominant paradigm.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's well, you're resisting, and you're showing other people, you're leading people, others to resist. So that can't be a bad thing.
I'm trying in any event, and along those lines, I want to make a pitch before I get off the air here. Michael Sosabe's film called Somewhere in New Mexico Before the End of Time premieres in Tucson, Arizona, on the campus of the University of Arizona, on Saturday, May 4th, and after that will be available for wide distribution via DVD and so forth. Mike put 2 years of time and a lot of his own money into this project, and so I'm asking
Mexico?
People. somewhere in New Mexico before the end of time.
Mike Sosby is
the filmmaker, and you can learn much more about the film on my website, GuyMcPherson.com.
All right. Thank you. GuyMcPherson.com. Look him up. Nature Bats Last is the website.
That's right.
After you get into it. So he's got a lot of things there. And you have also recommended Deep Resistance and a few of these, organizations.
I support resistance in any form. And currently some of those forms include Occupy and Idle No More and the voice and images of Occupy, Blazing Cat Productions, and Deep Green Resistance. There's a lot of ways that people can contribute to resistance that go beyond their direct involvement. You don't have to throw your body in front of a bulldozer on the Keystone XL pipeline. You can support these other organizations that are doing the heavy lifting.
Exactly. That's a good idea. So thank you guys so much. Always like talking with you.
Thank you, Ruth Ann. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
She lied, she cheated, she beat it, and that's a star.
And that is Baby, You Gave Me More. Drazi Hoops, hi.
Hi.
Drazi isn't crazy?
Drazi, it's Drazi Hoops.
Isn't crazy.
Yeah. Yes.
Hey, singer, songwriter, musician, all of these things?
All of those.
All definitely. Of those, and that's one of your songs. And what is this new album called?
This is The Sound Of.
Sound Of.
... But yes, it's that's the first song on the fine record that I'm just released April 9th, and I'm trying to turn people on to. So,
well, you were brought to my attention by somebody who is on the phone who wants to say hi.
Oh, hi there.
Hi, hello. Hi, Sarit. How are you doing?
Hi. Great.
A long time no speak. We haven't spoken in a while.
Ah. But great music.
Oh.
I feel like I've almost spoken to you because we listen to your album here, and it's pretty amazing, I must say.
Oh, that's great. We really do have to see each other sometime soon. Do you ever make it up to New York? No, we're going to reconnect on the show. No, but
I hope so.
You're still living down in Tennessee, right?
Yes, yes.
Well, she is.
Lovely. But, yes, now, Drazi Hoops comes from, the name comes from a Captain Beefheart song, so I'm just, some people do say Drazi sometimes. It's often confusing for people. Some people confuse me as a hip-hop artist or of some sort, but But no, that's where the whole thing comes from. But
right, it's like, okay, this is not his given name. Yeah, I would think hip hop. The song we just played, "Baby, You Gave Me More." I mean, I don't know. It sounded like sort of a country music ballad, and then I went into an Irish lullaby. And
yeah, well, the record's kind of like that in that way. It does go, which confuses some people. But I kind of I've always been drawn to music that's not so obvious, and I like to think in the songwriting that I do that it's also not so obvious. I mean, the songs all come from very personal, emotional spaces, but I like to leave them open for people to find their own meaning.
Yeah. I know that a lot of songwriters, just like artists, and Sarita, musician and an artist, and sometimes you don't want to interpret for people because you want them to find their own, but still, it's nice to know what you're thinking when you're writing and singing.
Yeah, it's always it's a fine line always. I feel like the songs have interesting stories behind them. At the moment I try to explain them, it becomes, you know, I'm saying the song's about this or about that, and oftentimes it's more about something I'm going through, or that's the way I process it, and that's the way I communicate it. So, you know, that song's a very old song of mine that I really wrote and never thought I'd put on a record, but played it for somebody and they really liked it, and
yeah.
You know, wound up on this record. So, and this record is very much a collection of those kinds of songs. It's a lot of songs over the last actually 10 years or so that didn't make it on other records, but I played a lot live and really that have real personal significance to me. So I wound up actually recording two records at once when I did this, and this record is kind of is more Americana, mellower. The next one's not out yet, so I won't talk about that one. But okay. Yeah, there are some country influences. There's some, you know, I have pretty traditional influences in general, but I'm always just trying to do music that I don't know, speaks to my human condition at least. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and we know how interconnected we all are. So, speaking to your human condition, the rest of us, or at least some of us, you know, is going to strike those chords. Your major or leading song, whatever, on this is The Sound of One Heart Breaking. Am I right?
Well, that's the title track, at least. And that really was a kind of a unifying theme. And we just actually, my good friend James Urbaniak shot a video for it, which I'm anxious to see myself. I'm barely in it, which is, I think, a good sign. But
that's sort of funny. I was going to ask you because you said that you were doing a video for it, but you're barely in it. Well,
yeah, that one, I'm very, very much barely in. There's a few different storylines that all sort of come together, and he had this whole concept for it, so I let him run with it. So. But yes, it's always been kind of a that's a song that I close shows with often, and it's a very personal, kind of emotional song, more about my connection to the world than about a specific relationship or some such thing, which a lot of people misread the songs, but that's, again, I don't correct people in that regard, because I feel like whatever they feel is, you know, speaks to them about the music.
Exactly. It resonates for them on a certain level. I'd like to play that now. Even though you closed your shows with it, we're
opening this one.
Right. But yeah, let's hear it. This is The Sound of One Heart Breaking.
Feels like we lost all those days. was the good fight. It was a reason to believe. My love was certain. My soul was hurting. With so much to be conceived. Feels like we found our way out of this haze. Those memories are lost in a day. Better instead we should look straight ahead. With every new day I'm amazed.
The sound of one heart breaking. I'll take every breath that I can. Cause what I found is no mistaking. I'll take it to be who I am.
But if I remember right, it was the good fight. It was a reason to believe.
Oh yeah, sound of one heart breaking. Now, you mentioned the fact that you were barely in, but singing the video for
yeah.
that recently, and then you did another video.
Yes, we did a video for the one of the two covers I do, which is "Whip It" by Devo, which was a very spontaneous cover that came up because all the songs went down very well, and I just sort of, we sort of put it together in the studio, but it came out quite unique, I think. So people have been digging that one and commenting quite a bit on it, so they had an inspired idea for that, hopefully, as well. I'm in that one a lot more, I'll have to say, so we'll see how that goes. I'm going to see these videos in a couple of weeks, I think.
Were these the first videos that you have done?
Yeah, I mean, I've done some kind of experimental, weird videos myself that on a couple of my records, Hey Sunshine and That Which Doesn't Kill You, I have some weird, they're more like video collages and things. These are kind of more linear concept videos with a story and
storyline,
actors and, you know, a whole crew and a whole bunch of people. It's really put together it looked like quite a good production, so I'm anxious to see it. It's they're directed by James Urbaniak, who was in, he's Dr. Venture on the Venture Brothers like cartoon, but he's in American Splendor and Henry Fool, a bunch of movies and TV and things like that. But and David Avalone, who I just met through this whole process. But
hey, how did this happen? How were you approached?
Well, I approached them. James is also my brother-in-law, so that was the key connection. And he hasn't really directed. He does a lot of vines. I don't know if you know what those are, on the whole Twitter vine thing. He's doing a lot of entertaining things, and I suggested it to him, and he basically really ran with it. So he just flew out here from L.A. and he shot a couple videos, and it was a lot of fun. So hopefully that'll come through. You got a lot of great actors to be involved as well. Maria Dizia, a lot of good people. So I'm anxious to see them, and we'll see. So it sounds interesting coming over the phone here.
Yeah, of course it's going to sound good.
No, it's lovely. But it's the first kind of video of this sort that we've done, and it's I'm excited about it. The record just came out, so I'm still trying to find ways to bring it to more people and get it into more areas where people can sort of check out the rest of it. And I like the fact that those two songs were done because they show the really different sides of the record. The one's a lot more rock, and the other one's, you know, this one's another country-ish, mellowish kind of emotional song. So I think the record really does, you know, swing wildly from, you know, one song to the next, but not in a incongruous way, I feel like, at all.
It blends well. But,
I don't. I think for some people, they really expect music nowadays to be very segmented and to fit some genre or category. And I have a hard time telling people I play this kind of music or that kind of music. Based on those two songs, you would think I play very Americana, mellowish music. But I do really go a lot of different ways with it. So, which I hopefully we'll get into in this discussion. But
You were talking about how they want something to fall right in to one box or another, and it seems like the record producers, I'm going to say like the big ones, but the names that everybody's familiar with or used to be, that they really want that, and that's why there's so much more indie work going on.
Yeah, well, I think it's easier for them, and it's easier if they can just sort of say, this is like, you know, this is a hip hop record. This is a country record. This is a, I have friends of mine who think, oh, you should really promote yourself in country music. And I there's a lot of purists out there and who expect you. They're just thrown by, you know, the second song's already like kind of a funk, different kind of song, and a lot of it's very rock, and a lot of it's very, you know, eclectic in its own way. So, you know, I like music like that. I was, you know, the first records I got into were like the White Album, and, you know, my folks had that on 8-track, and I really just absorbed that kind of thing. I like a wide swing of, you know, just song to song, but I like records that are complete records, and that sort of, I feel like the songs work best in the context of the whole album. I feel like, you know, hopefully each song stands up on its own, but I always think in terms of the flow of the record and sort of like a little movie, and you're telling a story. And this record's very much like that, where I'm sort of building to a crescendo on the whole thing. And, you know, I don't put my favorite song first, or I don't know if I have a favorite song. And, you know, it's sort of more, I'm trying to create a mood. I'm trying to build an emotional sense of the whole thing. And I don't know if people have the patience for that nowadays. There's a very short attention span kind of. I think there's people out there looking for that. At least I like to tell myself that. So I'm trying to find those people too. So, but I do, you know, I still think in terms of old school long play records, you know.
Yeah. Well, but I think, and yeah, and tonight I've totally just chopped up the way I'm playing these from the way you did them.
No, but that's nice too. I mean, I think again they should work that way as well. But I think we're getting to a culture with iTunes and all that where people just buy songs; they don't even buy the record. They'll pick a thing.
Right.
And whatever people like, again, I'm down with that if someone's moved by one song and wants to do that. But I still think in terms of records, and I tend to buy records or as much as I buy anything nowadays, but that song's you know, the last one we played is one I've been playing a lot because it's one that I like to put my daughter to sleep with. I just had a baby a few months ago, so it really for some reason works on her in that regard. So it's really, you know, as I said, one that's very important to me and has been kind of with me for the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years I've been doing that one. So,
well, then segueing right into From the Baby to a song called Baby Jesus, what is the main theme of this one?
Well, that's another, I feel like it's a complicated song in that regard where it's sort of about the way religion is used. It works on a couple different levels. It also sort of pokes fun at myself and my desire to be a writer, a songwriter who needs to, you know, develop followers and inspire people to like Jesus, basically. But it also sort of talks about, you know, it was definitely a product of the Bush years and the sense that there's this up is down faith-based reality doesn't matter. I don't know. Religion's used a lot by people to sort of fool people or discriminate mm-hmm. against people, and I've never been able to understand that very much. You know, some people think, oh, it's you're gonna piss off Christians, and that's not my intention at all, or it's not even what the song is about at all. But I get really annoyed with the way religion is used, and our country has really gone down a strange path with a lot of that. I feel like, and a lot of this is a reflection on kind of the, you know, up is down, misinformation.
World's peace.
Yeah.
No, and I feel like the song's very complicated, but it's also kind of about my own struggles to communicate and to sort of find a place to go with what I've been trying to do with art. And so it's kind of, I think it's one of my best songs or favorite songs, and that it works on a very kind of complicated level.
Yeah.
And it pokes fun at myself, but it also sort of speaks to the cultural phenomena that's going on. Still today, I still think we're very, you know, led by charlatans. And I guess I'm wondering why I can't be a better charlatan myself and convince people of a better path, you know. But
maybe having ethics has something to do with it. But you seem to be able to communicate well. But we're going to play this and see what you were thinking when you wrote it. So this.
Now and then, start again, and there's happiness just past the end.
We've got Sarit here. You met going to college. Were you both doing art and music at that time?
Yes, very much. I was in a band called Atomic Cafe back in Boston, and Sarit was going to the museum school, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, yeah, very much so. And Sarit's done the photos to a couple of the covers of my records. They were all probably taken around the same period. My first and second records, I think, definitely, which are called Straight to Black and The Infinite Starlight, were both with pictures from Sarit. I think Sarit might even be pictured on one of those records, or at least one of the pressings of one of those records, because I loved her photography so much. Yeah. And back in the day, she's always done a lot of different things, but she did a lot of photography. I don't know if she's doing that as much as music and painting these days, but... But that was back in the 90s, I believe. So we're both very young and all, but no.
Yeah,
it was a while ago. Yeah, it was quite a while ago. That was a wonderful period, a very creative time. I learned a lot, met a lot of people. I live in New York now, which is exciting in its own way, but that was a good time for me. I actually come from the Midwest, Illinois, Wisconsin, then Boston, then here. But anything to add to that, Sarit? Our past...
No, that was good.
I've summed that up pretty well.
That's good.
That's good. No, we did a lot of wacky projects together, so it was fun. A fun time.
Well, I think it's cool that you've kept in touch. And even though, like I said, you haven't seen each other for a while, but still, I mean, you're in touch, and that's really nice. And I really thank Sarit for, you know, she messaged me, hey, you should hear this music, listen to this.
Yeah,
well,
I thank her
for that as well. I need more.
It's exciting.
More people like Sarit out there doing the same thing, spreading the word. But
yeah.
My logo that I sometimes use for my label is a friend of ours, and did that. So she introduced me to a lot of good people. Sarit's always been about, turning people on to great art. She also turned me on to a lot of great music. I remember that back in the day. So she's turned me on to my favorite Nicks, the Nick Cave, and the Nick Drake, and stuff like
thank
that.
Thank you.
I very much appreciate that. I feel like in a lot of ways those people have, the music she's turned me on to has really stuck with me through the years and informed a lot of what I do and, you know, and vice versa, hopefully. I think Sarit's been a great friend through the years.
Yeah.
So
she's a very loyal person, too. On top of all her other...
Thank you, guys. You guys are great.
This is a Sarit love fest going on now. Yeah. No, I think you very much deserve it. So, it's been a while, unfortunately. I've really been kind of... it's been like 4 years since I released a record, I think, or three and a half or something like that. But, and I've really... I had, well, I won't get into the details of the last few years, but last year I did have a baby, which is very exciting, and some good things and some bad things as far as why it's taken a while, but as I said, I've got kind of two done right now, and the next one's going to hopefully come out end of the year or early next year, but I'm trying to give this one a chance to get heard and get out there and see what, I just find people, and so far the response has been good. It's been exciting to release some music, and I'm hoping to play some more shows and maybe get on the road a bit. But with the baby, I'm kind of happy to be homebody.
Drazy Hoops at www.drazyhoops.com. And yeah. Sure, the baby has been probably an inspiration. You're talking to me about looking at things a little more positively, and so you haven't been quite as...
Well, I haven't been quite as involved in politics in the sense that a lot of it can be kind of despair inducing, but I don't actually try to, I'm more of an optimist in that regard too. I really like to think that there's beautiful, smart people being born to this world all the time, and they'll solve the problems that the less beautiful, less smart people are creating right now. But you know, we'll see how it goes. It's a ongoing struggle, and I like to think that that's my music as well, that there's always kind of a thread of optimism and a sense of, more of a positive view of the world. I don't want to be someone out there just spewing, adding to the negativity of the world. I mean, I feel like there's sometimes things that have to be exposed and things that have to be spoken about, but even that, I don't think that's negative. I think that's a positive. I think it's better to look at things and try to be truthful and try to, you know.
Well, you know that phrase now, that speaking truth to power.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not a negative thing. And you have a song called Sick Enough.
Yes.
I like that because it says you're sick enough to try something new.
Exactly. Yeah.
Let's listen to that.
The endless spew and spout of empty hatred really leaves no doubt that nothing's sacred. A whisper can't be shouts to all the fakers. Aren't you sick of being lied to? Sick enough to try something new? Aren't you sick of being lied to? Just enough to maybe face the truth. Thank you.
Crazy hoops. So, sick enough to try something new, and something new, one of the something new is a brand new baby.
Yes. Now, it's very exciting, very tiring. I haven't slept a long chunk in many, many months. I've never been a big sleeper, always been a bit of an insomniac, so that comes in handy, but testing the limits of that these days, but she couldn't be sweeter, and it's a real inspiring, mind-blowing, life-changing event. Needless to say, she brings me endless joy, and right now I'm, as part of the idea of finishing two records, though, I knew I wanted to stay home a lot and sort of be able to enjoy this whole time, and it has been very enjoyable. This week has been kind of hard with Mama Hoops going back to work and so more responsibilities. But no, she makes an appearance in the video for Whip It, so you'll get to see her.
Oh, okay.
Her acting debut at 5.5 months, but her job was mostly to be cute, which I think she did.
Well, of course. But now did she have to get a what's that? SAG or something?
Yeah, she doesn't have a speaking part, so I think you need to do that when you get a...
still singing. Okay, she doesn't have a part yet. Okay.
But it's been very nice. It's been very great, and it does really sort of make me think more about the future, and just wanting to take better care of myself and make sure I can be around there to see, the future.
Sure.
And the world in general, and the planet that we're destroying and all that stuff. I'm, again, trying to focus on the positive of it. But
Well, now, you get some play on college stations, and you told me that Brian Eno's song has been getting the Golden Hours that you do. It's getting a good play.
Yes, that has been, that's been doing well. Like, both the covers. I think people tend to like to connect with songs that they kind of know, although that's a more obscure song that I don't think has quite the, wide knowledge that the Devo song does. But that was Brooke Demke sings a lot on that, and Lauren Balthrop. I have a lot of great people I work with, and it really came out nice, I thought. It was a very, very different take on the song, but emotionally and lyrically, that song really has always spoke to me and really makes a lot of sense to me. So I think it's just very beautiful lyrics.
Well, let's listen. We'll get you version for now.
Passage of time is flicking dimly up on the screen. I can't see the line I used to think I could read between. Perhaps my brain's turned to sand. Oh me, oh my,
think it's been an eternity. You'd be surprised at my degree of uncertainty. Evening slide away, watching the signs taking over from the fading day. Perhaps no place is
I love just some of the phrases, you know, degree of uncertainty, things like that. But it's, that's lovely.
Yeah.
So that's getting more play on the college.
Yeah, that one I've noticed a lot, and Whip It actually still does, as I said. But a lot of the songs, Baby Jesus has been getting a surprising amount of play, and it's really, you know, I just sort of find out dribs and drabs as to what people are taking to. I'm you know, as I said, to me it's all kind of personally meaningful, and I have a hard time really pinpointing, I don't know, what sums up the sound of what I'm trying to do, or so,
yes.
You know. But no, I appreciate you playing so much of it. It's it saves me from rambling on and on too.
Played everything, but, because it's, you know, you've got so much good music. But I have to admit that one of the things that, and there again it's the words, Sticks and Bars.
Yes.
I'm going to play that. This is a 2-minute song, and it may be my favorite. I'm not sure. But let you catch the words to this. I just.
Sticks and bars for Cadillac cars from Venus to Mars. You only see stars, and the distance is great, filled with love. And with hate, I'm left with these songs to try and relate. Resentment runs deep, as in how do you sleep? The price is so steep, which dreams will you keep? Words that we say.
sight, out of mind. Something so real and so hard to define.
Wow. I love some of those phrases in there.
Great. Now, that's one of my favorite songs, too. It's like really a, again, it's a more of an old song. My last record was supposed to be called Chicks and Bars, but somehow we ran out of time in the studio and it didn't get cut. But it's always been kind of a crowd favorite and one I've been playing for years. So I really am happy that it finally made it on a record. And then, as I said, this record's kind of a collection of those. And so it's a really personally... I don't know. I have a funny story behind it, but I don't know.
You want to tell us?
Nah, it's kind of inspired by the way somebody quit the band once. They wrote me kind of a nasty letter, but about why I do music and things like that. But I guess that's not that funny to anyone else. It's funny to me. but it's kind of, some people can't leave. They just have to try to trash you on the way out the door or something. But it kind of inspired a very poignant song in my mind, and one that's always meant a lot to me. So I like that you like that one. But now it's this is really a collection of these kind of stream of consciousness songs, and songs that sort of, a lot of my favorite songs, they flow out very quickly when I'm writing them. They kind of almost in real time. Some of them I don't change anything, and some of them I just tweak a thing here or there. And some of them I labor over for months. But, I mean, this record's a lot more of the ones that are kind of emotional reactions to life events and things that happened. And in that regard, I, as I said, it's a very personal record.
It seems that way. I mean, it seems like these are coming from the heart. You can be found on Facebook at drazy.hoops.music.
Yes. And actually, if you go there, you can stream the whole record through a site called Beats Per Minute. It's not up on their site anymore, but there's a link through my site. So if people want to check it out for free for a little bit longer, you can find it there. And I urge people to do that. As I said, I like it as a whole concept record. So, you know, I like it when people check out the whole thing. And yeah, that's one way to find it right now. You can find it everywhere, basically, but some places they make you pay this and that. And you know, I'm into people paying, but I'm also just into people hearing it and getting into it and trying to find people to spread the word and get attached to the songs, you know. So
right. And that was another one to me, that the Chicks and Bars has a very country.
Yes. Well, I tried to do that with this record a little bit. There's a little bit of that on the next record, but it's actually got a very different flavor. But I tried to sort of put similar songs on records as opposed to, I don't know, having a little of everything on everything. But so this one, definitely I was kind of going that route where I was leaving, some of the more country-ish ones together. I'm not really deeply country influenced. I love some of the classic country music.
Right.
And
George Jones died today.
Yeah, that's sad.
Wow, he was 91 years old.
Well, that's a full life at least. But yes, and I'm not really connected to modern country music at all. I don't feel much. I don't know much about what's going on there at all. But a lot of the classic Hank Williams and, you know, not his idiot son, but. Yeah, a lot of, you know, Johnny Cash. And for me, you know, Neil Young is country music, too. So I like a lot of, you know, I'm not a purist in that regard. But no, I think it does come through. And I play with a really great pedal steel player, Bob Hoffner, who's currently living down in Texas. But he's been on my last few records, and he really adds that flavor, you know, as does the producer, co-producer, Gary Maurer, has a real sense of traditional country, and he's from the band Hem, and they do a lot of very lush countryish kind of things as well. So there's definitely a heavy country influence. But I also play with a great guitar player named Sean Eden from the band Luna, formerly. They're no longer in existence, but So it's kind of an eclectic gathering of people, I think, to
yeah.
make a very unique sound, I like to think. But some of it, I like that we sort of delved into some more traditional sounding
Well, now, do you travel quite a bit, or are you basically more in New York City area right now, or what?
I'm more in the New York City area right now, and I don't have any plan. I have played around the country a bit, and I've not done too many major tours, more spot shows and cities, and I've played in the Midwest a bit. I have played in San Francisco and London, and I make it around the Northeast a bit. I haven't been playing a lot of shows in the last couple of years either, so I'm hoping to sort of pick up the pace with that a bit, but not immediately. I'm actually, as I said, still trying to settle in with my situation. I'm thinking with the next record as it comes out, I'm hoping to build off of this one and get some kind of road thing going to support that one. But I have a show in New York May 12th at Tom's Treehouse, it's called.
Tom's Treehouse, okay.
But it's a nice little show. It's acoustic, and they project it on a big wall across the street. It's at the Club 2A on May 12th. But so that will be a fun show. But and I just did a record release party at the Living Room, which is a kind of a great club here. So I'm trying to play more, and I'm trying to get out more. I'd like to play. I'd like to play more around the country. I'm hoping to get down to Austin this year. And so I don't know, but it's more spot shows here and there, and it's hard to get a good tour together. But I'm hoping to play a lot more as the year progresses.
Okay, well, let's hope. Because you really have some great music. You need to be heard.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I appreciate you playing that. So playing the music, I feel like that's half the battle. It's a very, you know, there's 1,000 records come out every week, and everything's, you know, a lot of good stuff and a lot of
not so good
stuff. And it's hard to figure out where you fit in and find a place for it all. But
I think Sarita agrees with me. She's there someplace.
She's still there? Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. You would agree that this is some of the great stuff that's coming out, right?
Oh, yeah.
There she is.
She's there, yeah.
Well, I appreciate that. Now,
it's rare that I even like something that much. Very hard to find good stuff nowadays. Thank you.
Yeah, well,
it's refreshing.
Thank you. I feel the same way. I mean, I'm always searching, and I like it when... I like when I discover something new, and it's, you know, I'm just trying to make music like the music that speaks to me and that makes me feel less alone in the world. And,
it speaks heavily, yeah.
I feel like the songs all come from a real place and from a real emotional space, and I'm hoping that connects with people. So.
Oh, I think so. And yeah, because I mean, even the songs that are sort of sad, and I do want to say there's some love songs on here, even though we may not have played many. We're going to go out with Fly Little Bird. I want to say again, this is Drazy Hoops. You can find him at drazyhoops.com or drazy.hoops.music on Facebook. And his music is on Facebook right now.
Yes.
So,
please do check it out.
And thank you so much. And I love this song because it's very optimistic. That's why I wanted to just end with it, because I think it is, you know. And I was actually thinking about your daughter.
Yeah, actually, this is another one that I play for her quite a lot, and she quite likes. You know, she's 5.5 months old, so it's hard to tell what she likes, but you can tell what she sort of zones in. And,
I hit that, because it's like, okay, I bet.
That's nice. No, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for coming on, and Sarit for lending moral support.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll have to catch up off air sometime.
Yes, you guys will. Thank you both, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Time for a foolish game.